Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Constructive Conversations, your source for anything and everything construction related and a whole lot more. As you'll see today, we have the whole lot more side of the podcast. We have a dandy for you today. I'm going to introduce today's guest. A lot of you will already know who he is by the time I'm halfway through his introduction or through the first couple sentences. So today's guest is a name synonymous with grit, gold, and groundbreaking work, both in the field and on television. We're honored to welcome Dave Turin, or better known to millions as Dozer Dave, a civil engineer, quarry expert, and gold mining veteran whose journey from managing his family's rock quarry in Oregon to becoming a household name on the Discovery Channel is nothing short of remarkable. So Dave holds a degree in civil engineering and spent over 25 years in the construction and quarrying industry before he stepped into the spotlight. He first appeared on Gold Rush in 2008 as a trusted consultant for the Hoffman crew, filming seven seasons, and he quickly became a full-time cast member thanks to his deep knowledge of earth moving, leadership under pressure, and relentless work ethic. Over the course of seven seasons, Dave helped lead mining operations in Alaska, Oregon, and even South America, earning the nickname Dozer Dave for his mastery of heavy equipment. But his story didn't stop there. Dave went on to star in several spinoffs, including Gold Rush, Dave Turin's Lost Mine, which he filmed four seasons, where he led a team to revive abandoned mines across the U.S., appearing in 69 episodes. He also filmed a season of Gold Rush Winter's Fortune, showcasing the challenges of mining in extreme conditions. And most recently, America's Backyard Gold, a fresh take on gold mining that brought Dave back to his roots, helping everyday Americans uncover hidden riches in their own backyards using ingenuity instead of expensive equipment. Beyond television, Dave is a passionate advocate for the trades, encouraging young people to pursue careers in construction, mining, and engineering. He's a firm believer in hard work, resilience, and the power of community, values that have guided him through both business and broadcast. So whether you're in construction, mining, or just love a good story about perseverance, purpose, innovation, and entrepreneurialism, this episode is packed with insights from a man who's lived it all. So please welcome to the podcast, Dave Turin. How you doing, Dave?
I'm good. Well, thanks, Eddie. And by the way, that was quite an introduction. I don't know. You got all that, but that was quite flattering, and I appreciate it.
Well, I will say that I have watched practically every episode of Gold Rush since it came out. Still watch Dave Turin's Lost Mines episodes. I've caught some of the America's Backyard Gold. I watched the Bering Sea Gold, all the gold shows. I just have thoroughly enjoyed throughout the last, decade and a half or so of watching.
Been a long time.
Yes.
Been a long time.
It's been, it's kind of a fanboy of me to say, but it's been a part of my evenings for a long time. And, I've really enjoyed following your career in it, your crews, some of the others. And, it's just an honor to have you on the show today. It was an easy write for the introduction when you think about everything that you've done in both your career and in television. So
well, thank you.
Very honored to have you on today's episode. And I'm going to try to do it justice. Like I said to you before, I'm a professional CPA, not a professional podcast host. We're going to have a great conversation. So Dave, could you start off with giving our audience a little bit of background on your early careers in civil engineering, your family quarry, and how you got into Gold Rush and the subsequent spinoffs?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we can go way back. My dad was a teacher and a coach, high school teacher and a coach, and came from a family of five siblings. There's six kids in the family. And so we were a very tight family. We did a lot of things together. We grew up together at the base of Mount Hood when there weren't any people there. So we grew up for a love of hunting and fishing and being in the outdoors. And it was when I was like 12 years old, we paved a couple driveways. One was our own driveway, because Dad did that for summer work going through college. And the neighbors saw the paving that we did, and they were, they all wanted their driveway paved. And so it started, and Dad actually quit teaching and coaching to start a paving company. Well, he had four sons that were all young. I was 12 or 13. Got two older brothers, one younger brother, and we just started paving driveways. And then that's when Dad quit teaching and coaching. And then Dad always included us in the business. I remember when we bought our first asphalt plant, Dad made us owners. And then we went from that to I finally graduate from college, and I decided I have an engineering degree. I'm married and I have three kids, and I decided that I wanted, you know, a new challenge. And so I started looking for work in the engineering. I took the family, loaded us up. We went to Arizona. We went to California, went to Nevada, and I was looking for work. And it was, you know, in the late 80s, I guess, and the economy wasn't doing real well. But anyway, when I came back home, Dad told me, he goes, "Hey, Dave, you know, the quarry that we have our asphalt plant set up in, they're not doing well. They're about ready to go bankrupt." He goes, "I want to make him an offer." And he said, Dad said, if I make him an offer, would you come back and manage the rock quarry?" And I thought to myself, new challenge, something I've never done. And I was 28 years old, and I said, let's go for it. Managed that for, gosh, close to 30 years. And it was interesting because everybody asks me how I met Todd Hoffman and how I got on Gold Rush. It was pretty random. My three children all graduated from college at the same time. One was pre-med. One got her. No, it was when my son did graduate with his optometry. He was a doctor of optometry. My oldest daughter got a master's degree in finance. My youngest daughter got her teaching degree. So she's a teacher. And we wanted to throw a little party for him, basically family. And, you know, we thought 80 to 100 people and friends. And so I had heard that in Sandy, there was a family that owned an airport, and they had a really nice lodge. So we went there and met Georgia Hoffman. And as we're looking around, Todd Hoffman was sitting on the couch, and he looks over at me and he goes, "Hey," he goes, "aren't you that guy from the rock quarry?" I said, "Yeah, I am." We introduced each other, shake hands, and he goes, "I want to show you something." So we walk out the backyard, and he's got a bunch of old equipment that he bought from an auction. And he starts telling me the story. He goes, "I want to go gold mining with my best friend, Greg, and my dad and my two boys." And he goes, "What do you think of this equipment?" And I thought to myself, not good. It's not good at all. It's pretty beat up equipment. He's going to go to Alaska. And I didn't want to, you know, squelch his enthusiasm and his passion. So I said, "You know, we might be able to work it out." So I just helped the brother out. When we started, I was just there to help a guy out because he's, you know, lives in the same community. And Todd Hoffman's, he's very persuasive. He's a good negotiator and he's pretty charismatic. So I was like, "All right, let's go." And along the way, as I'm helping him, we helped him with some pumps, brought him up to the quarry, showed him screening and moving dirt and pumping water and all those kind of things. And we wired up his first generator. And along the way, he says to me, he goes, "I'm going to try to get a TV show." And he goes, "I think I'm getting close." And I thought to myself, good luck, buddy. I wonder how that'll work. Because I thought that's the dumbest idea I've ever heard. Who wants to watch a bunch of guys mining? I thought to myself, that's just dumb. But I thought, you know what? I'll just help him out, help him along the way. Well, he calls me later in the spring and he goes, "Hey, I'm loading up to go to Alaska." He goes, "Will you come help me load up?" And I said, "Sure, I'll come down and help you." So I show up and lo and behold, there's producers, there's cameramen, there's sound guys. And I was like, oh my goodness, he pulled it off. So that was the first time I was on TV. We, you know, I was just real briefly, I was there helping them load, strap things down, rig things, and they head off. And that was in May. He calls me back up the end of June and he goes, "I can't get my wash plant started. Could you come up and help me?" And again, I was like, dumb idea. But for me, Alaska, gold, and TV, I'm like, all right, I'm in. So I went up there that in July. I was supposed to be there 7 days. I think it took me 10 or 11 days to get his plant started up. Got the plant started. Everything's, yeah, let's go. And then I went back home and I thought, well, that was kind of cool. They called me back up again in September. And so that first year, I think we did 10 episodes and I was in three or four of them. And so that was my first, you know, adventure in gold mining and my first adventure in TV. And it was unbelievable. I remember sitting at home because I wasn't on like maybe the first three or four episodes. I watched three or four episodes of the show and I'm like, boy, this is not going well. They show these guys as inept and don't know what they're doing. And I'm thinking to myself, I wonder how they're going to show me. Well, they show me in a good light. I was kind of like the subject matter expert and got them going. And anyway, my wife and I looked at each other and go, boy, that went okay. And then that year, the next year, they asked me to join their crew. And I said, nah, I can't do that because I've still got my family business. Because up till this point, I had never been paid. I mean, you know, I just kind of did it to help those guys out. Well, then the second season, they were offering me a little bit of money and it wasn't much. And I just was kind of like, nah, I don't think that's a real good idea. So we worked it out. I spent half the time mining for gold and half the time running the family business. And then it wasn't until season three that we negotiated a good contract and I joined the TV and the crew full time.
That sounded like a great adventure or opportunity for a great adventure that just ended up being life-changing after that point. That's a great story about how you got into all that.
And it was life-changing, Eddie. It was life-changing. You know, I used to think before I started on Gold Rush, I thought in my own mind, I said, I'm a really good miner, but I was mining in this little tiny piece on this one piece of ground that I'd mined for 30 years. And I adventure out into something that I've never done before. And I thought to myself, I'm probably the worst miner in the world because I had no idea. I mean, I did some research, you know, like where does gold, it formed and how it got into these places that we're going to mine. And I did some research into Alaska and the Yukon Territory. So, I mean, I wasn't completely ignorant. But the other thing that is interesting that people don't realize is the TV did not want us to be experts. Along the way, they wanted people to learn with us. So, for instance, I always wanted to check with the neighbors, because most miners, if you're humble enough and you're not a know-it-all and you ask for their help, miners are mostly, you know, helpful people. And in the beginning, they didn't want us to ask questions. They wanted me to learn and stumble and fall. So that way the audience learned. And it was pretty amazing. I think that is one of the, you know, the key ingredients to the success of this show is that people learned along with us. I never came across as knowing it all and trying to tell everybody that I knew it all. I wanted to learn I like to learn. I like new challenges. I like to, you know, be adventurous and explore new things. So that's part of me. And I felt like that enthusiasm, that passion came out. And I think that was part of the reason for my success on the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've definitely learned a bit or two about mining just from watching. Like I'll watch an episode and I'll be like, all right, how much more do they have of overburden do they have to move before they get down to pay? And then they got to run that. And how many tons are they going to run? How many ounces per hour is that material? You know, just things like that. And I'm like, I don't really know the first thing about mining, but I learned a little bit about the general background of it.
Eddie, you wouldn't believe how many people I talked to. And just like in August, I was in Alaska. And I was up there helping Wani Barra out. And I met two different operators up there that said to me, says, you're the reason I'm doing this. I go, what? He goes, well, we figured if you guys could do it, we could go gold mining. And and they were like, yeah, we learned a lot from the show. And and that's the reason they're up there doing it. So it's pretty cool. And the other thing is, Eddie, like yourself, you're a CPA. I mean, I've had doctors and lawyers and, you know, business people go, I love your show, you know, and I love the, you know, all those kind of things. So it goes, I mean, it's pretty broad spectrum of the people that have watched the show.
Yeah, it definitely transcends to a wide audience.
It's a
neat process, and I think it's everybody gets a little bit of gold fever just watching the show.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. So what were some of the biggest challenges you faced when you were running through all your businesses and your career and even in your mining, and how'd you overcome those?
I think the challenges I've always had is a couple things. Because I've always been adventurous, I've been the guy that has a vision for bigger and better things. And I feel like my dad was that guy. I've become bored with running the same rock quarry and the same piece of ground for 30 years. And my dad and I were always the two in our business structure that had a vision. So I was always the guy bringing new ideas, you know, whether it was like I've tried to open a rock quarry, and went through the whole permitting process. We've tried to buy and sell, you know, some things. And in our own business, I have an older brother, and he was always the finance guy. And so it was hard to cast that vision to other people because I want to risk it all. And my brother was much more conservative. So, and it's the same with some of the other businesses, you know, like when I got on Gold Rush, I'm like, hey, we need to go here. And I would try to make decisions based on how much gold we can get, because I've always been a production guy. And to get like my brother, who was more conservative on finances, and then to get like Todd Hoffman on, you have to be persuasive. And I feel like it's leadership. If you can cast that vision and cast it in a way that it makes sense. So the obstacles for me were basically my risk and how much I wanted to go do something. And I had to cast that vision to other people. And I feel like that's business, right? And as you build your business, you can't, because like in our family business, we at one point we were up to 40 or 50 employees. Well, I can't have a personal connection with all 50 people. However, if I've got five or six guys that I can cast that vision, and then they cast that vision, I think that's leadership and being able to cast the vision. And I think you can overcome a lot of obstacles if you continue to communicate and cast that vision.
A book that I'm really big on is Extreme Ownership, How Navy SEALs Lead and Win.
And I read that book.
That's one of the principles, belief in the mission. And that just, what you're saying just resonates to that principle. You're getting everybody on board with the mission, with where you're trying to lead them. And you do that and they're going to follow you. You're leading, and leading becomes easy.
And I'm a firm believer in it, just like that book, Extreme Ownership. You've got to own it. You got to sell it. You know, you're leading has to believe it. And, I know what it was. The one question you asked about, what was it?
Was it high pressure environments and sharing an example?
Yeah. So I was going to give you an example of a leadership quality, and it comes with that. When we were season 3 of Dave Turn's Lost Mine, you probably saw this. I had a dear friend die of a heart attack on screen, and it was a really difficult time. I mean, and we were isolated because it was during COVID. And so with the COVID, we were still filming, but we had this bubble and we couldn't really go outside of that bubble because the people inside that bubble were all safe. We're not going to give COVID back and forth. But because of that, we couldn't go out and get help. And so really we had ourselves. My wife was there. My grandson was there. My 6 guys were there. So we were a small group. And we had just lost a beautiful man, loved the guy, and he loved all of us. And we were family and a team. And we were grieving. But the problem was, how do you come out of that? And how long do you, you know, mourn and grieve? And it got to be a problem because everybody was, you know, we'd sit around a campfire and we'd reminisce and we started drinking. And this went on for I mean, a good amount of time. It was 5 or 6, 7, 8 days, something like that. And finally, I was like, gentlemen, we got to do something. We can't just continue to do this. And I said, I'm going to work tomorrow. I'm going to put my boots on and I'm going to start back to work. And I said, I hope you guys join me. If you don't, I understand. If it's going to take a little more time, I understand. Well, the next morning, everybody was ready to go to work. Uh-huh. And we went to work and we had our radios and we were able to talk through things. But because we had a purpose, because we had a reason, you know, I believe we're meant to get off our butts and actually go do something. We need a purpose in life. And once we had that purpose, we started healing and we all bounced back. And I feel like we healed and we came back from that stronger, a stronger team, a stronger family. And we did. And I'm still pretty tight with some of those guys.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great.
But that's the extreme ownership. You know, a good leader has to pull himself up too and go, all right, let's go. We've got something to do.
Right. That's a great example of leadership. Yeah, I remember that episode in that time period, and just having been through losses, can imagine what you all were going through. But you know, that's to tell your team it's time. And yeah, for them to follow you back into battle, so to say.
Yep. Yeah. That's quite a journey. But that's life. I mean, everybody, we all face it. Mm-hmm. And it's how we deal with it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So when we're talking about, since we're talking about leadership, what qualities do you look for when you're building a team? I know watching all the episodes of all the seasons of all the different crews, of all the different shows, there's kind of a central theme that there's a team. You know, everybody's, you know, talking about team. We're going to pull together as a team, do this. And a lot of times it's close knit. It's more like a family than it is a team, as you've mentioned and as we've seen in episodes. So when you're putting your team together, what sort of qualities do you look for?
So it's a good question. And my philosophy has evolved. My dad instilled teamwork, you know, within us as a family, as a company. We were always a team. He always included people. He always included them. We always had a bonus system. We always had, you know, where if we do well, you're going to do well. And we always spent time with, you know, people. We would have Christmas dinners. We'd take trips together. So dad instilled that teamwork in us. And then, so you talk about team. I played a lot of team sports. I played a lot of football. I played some college football. So I love football because it's the ultimate team. And I don't feel like, you know, if you've got a great quarterback, he can't win games unless he has a line. If you have a great linebacker, he's not going to win games unless you have a great cornerback. So football, I love, is, in my opinion, is the ultimate team. You can't win with just one superstar. And so I've always loved that. But in the beginning, when I was first started, dad made me the paving foreman when I was like 18 years old. So I'm like, I got to learn how to manage older people. And I learned that if I just worked harder than everybody else, that was kind of how I would be able to lead. But in the beginning, I used to look for people that were competent and good at the task that I needed. For instance, if I needed a loader operator, I wanted somebody that had experience running the loader. And that's how I was as a young man. Well, what I found is there's a difference between how some people train compared to how I train. And later in life, what I have found is I'd rather have a clean slate. If the person is a good person, morally upright, if he or she, I enjoy hanging out with them, I enjoy their company, and they're good people, I would rather teach them my way of doing things. For instance, if I had a loader operator and he's got 30 years of experience, right? And I bring him on a site and I go, I need that truck loaded in 2 minutes. And he came from landscaping. And he looks at me and goes, there's no way you can load that truck in 2 minutes. Whereas if I hire a guy that was, he ran a corn combine, right? And he's pretty good at running the equipment. And I teach him how to run that excavator. And I tell him after he's proficient at it, I say, I need that truck loaded in 2 minutes. He doesn't know the difference, does he? So he's going to figure out a way to load that truck in 2 minutes. And so what I found is if I can find somebody that I can train and do it the way I want to do it, I'd rather do that sometimes than have somebody that's got 30 years of experience and they've done it their way.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
Oh, definitely. Definitely does. You know, we're just in the CPA profession. We're all the time. We'll put a team together for an audit engagement or some engagement, and we're constantly training newer staff. And, you know, when you put your team together, it's the same kind of concept. You want somebody that is going to be trainable. It doesn't necessarily matter how much experience they have. If you know they're going to be able to do the work. Now, certain areas do require, at least in our profession, experience, expertise. Yeah. But yeah, having the ability to be able to be trained and not just set in certain ways goes a long way, and at least for us also, in putting a team together.
Yep. Yeah. Yep. And it helps to be a team player.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
For sure. So one thing I'll send to you, you talk about your love for football. I put together a presentation, presented a couple times. It's called First and 100, a construction analogy to football. And I basically break down every part of a football team and the process of a football game and describe how that relates to construction.
I love it.
I'll send that to you. You might find it entertaining.
I will find that entertaining because I've used the same analogy in some talks that I've given. I've had the opportunity to, you know, speak in front of groups and stuff. And I like to use the analogy of football, which is to me the ultimate team, and how you have to build a team to be successful. And I love that.
So let's talk about innovation for a minute. You have decades of experience moving dirt, mining in the construction industry. I would imagine that you've seen not everything, but pretty close to it. So what are some of the innovations that you've seen or even implemented in mining or construction? And how do you see the role of innovation in traditional construction and mining industries impact operations?
I mean, some of the things that I have seen is the use of drones. My goodness, it changes things. And it's only been in the last, I remember when I started Gold Rush, we did a lot of the aerial shots with helicopters. And because the drones weren't invented, and that was only, I mean, you think about it, 15, 16, 17 years ago, we didn't have drones. And so to get that overhead shot of things, you would have to have a helicopter. I'll never forget that. I think it was season 2 on Gold Rush. I'm pushing with that little dozer and I'm pushing overburden, right? And I'm pushing it over a bank and they had a helicopter. It was one of the most exhilarating things I've ever experienced. I'm pushing and they're talking on the radio. They're like, okay, Dave, we're about ready to come up. But I'm pushing over this edge. And just as the stuff's going, this helicopter pops up and he's like, I mean, I'm literally 5 feet away from him that, you know, I'm just running the machine and here goes that helicopter over the top and off it went. And now drones are around us every single day when we're filming and stuff. So it's, you know, it's changed the TV and movie production world, but it's also changed construction because now you can, you know, from a, 5,000 foot of height, you can see your whole project.
Uh-huh.
And then the other thing that's pretty cool is now these drones have what they call LIDAR, which is light detection range or something like that. And what LIDAR does is it takes the vegetation away and it takes the houses away. So really what you see is just the surface of the land. And it's a great prospecting tool because a lot of times when I'm out there looking to see where somebody else's mined, you know, what has never been disturbed, what's virgin ground. If you take the vegetation away, right? I mean, even I've been fooled by a 100-year-old tree, right? A 100-year-old tree looks like a big tree. Well, they were mining 100 years ago. So I've been fooled and go, oh, that's virgin ground because look at the size of those trees. Now, it'd been mined and I've been fooled that way. But if you take LIDAR and you take all the vegetation away, now all you see is the ground. So now you can see where the ground's been turned up. You can see test pits. You can see test trenches. So that kind of stuff's really, really amazing. The other thing that's come into effect is what they call ground penetrating radar, which then tells you, you know, the different densities as you go down through, you know, from the surface down. You can see if there's like an overburden, which was our permafrost. It's got a different density as river gravels, which then has a different density of your base rock or your bedrock. And so with those, now you know, all right, I've got to go down 10 feet to get through the permafrost. I've got to go through 20 feet of, you know, cobbles and river rocks, and then I hit bedrock. So it's a great tool, which, you know, we never really had. We would have to try to figure it out as we went, you know, and look at other people's pits and things like that. And then for construction, I mean, really, it's the GPS things. The GPS has changed the world of excavation and running equipment. I mean, now you can get on a dozer and it's telling you you're 2 feet above. Now you're, as you're going, all right, you got to deposit this. So it's pretty incredible. I mean, I've always ran just from the feel of my machine, and now you've got all this technology and computers and GPS that tells you where you're going to deposit it, how much, what rate and things like that. So it's pretty neat. I mean, it's incredible in the last 10 or 15 years, how much our industry has changed.
Yeah. And I'm kind of big on AI because I know that it's definitely not going anywhere and it's just something that people are going to have to embrace. But even I feel like with robotics and mining, it's in construction, excavation. I've even heard of heavy equipment that will run automatically based off of GPS and,
oh yeah,
and specs. So, you know, it's kind of those things where it's like scary to think about, but it's probably not going away. In fact, like you said, it's just the next 15 years is going to be totally different from the last 15 years. The amount of innovation and even talk about drones. We've had that used in counting inventory for rock stockpiles.
Yes.
So, you know, they'll go up there, shoot pictures and take dimensions and things like that.
When you think of the safety aspect of underground mining. Now, underground mining, a lot of these guys sit, you know, in a safe zone, right? And they're mining on this, you know, this face. And they just shot it, right? And so there's always unstable rocks. So now he stands back in a safe room and he's running that machine and he digs it all out. And you can take pictures of the roof and you're like, okay, well, that needs to be fixed. And you can do that a lot by, you know, just remote control now. It's pretty incredible. And then it keeps people safe.
And that's a lot like the crawlers that you see up in Nome, underwater crawlers.
Oh, yeah.
You don't even have to send a diver down.
Yep. Pretty crazy.
Yeah, it's coming. Say Skynet from the Terminator is about to take over, but I think it'll just allow us to do more. Some of the big fear about that is it's going to replace people, but I think it just allows for more production. We've seen it over the years in accounting with technology, different programs and things like that. Just allowed us to do more and didn't replace anybody.
Yeah, I agree with you. My son is an optometrist. He's got 3 offices and he's using AI in so many areas of his business, you know, whether it's billing or whether it's, you know, doing a survey of his client or his customers or his patients, and he loves it. So he's kind of keeping me up to speak on it. I'm a little bit older, Eddie.
Yeah, not much. I mean, I'm trying to keep pace with the younger generation also, but, either keep pace or get left behind. And I still have too many years until retirement to get left behind. So I got to read up on it as much as possible.
Good.
So we're talking about, you know, AI and replacing people, but and not really joking about that. But the real issue that we do see, at least in West Virginia, are labor shortages. And you've become a mentor and advocate for the trade. So why is that mission so important to you?
I think, Eddie, that I've met so many people in business that barely got through high school and they become very, very successful. I'll give you an example. I have a nephew, my younger brother's oldest son. The poor guy he barely got through. I shouldn't say that. He's very successful, very, very intelligent, but he had a difficult time getting through high school. He just, you know, whether the focus, you know, staying on task, things like that. But you think about it, out of high school, he worked for us for a while. And then he went and he built race cars for NASCAR, came out of that, came back to work for another company. And then he started his own company with a partner. And he is probably doing, I'm going to guess he's probably got 40 or 50 employees. He's probably doing $40 million worth of work a year. He taught himself how to run computers. He taught himself how to do the GPS on his jobs. He taught himself. And the kid is just killing it. So if you look at, he took some welding classes out of school, but he really wasn't designed to go to a four-year school. So I've also got a niece that went to college. She went 4 years, got a degree in Bachelor's of Arts, and then didn't really know what to do after that. So she decided she wanted to be a physical therapist assistant, which was another 2 years. So let's compare that. So she was 6 years in college. That's a lot of money for my sister and my brother-in-law. And she really didn't start producing income, you know, and whatever you want to call it, taxes and stimulating the economy for 6 years, whereas my nephew immediately went to work, bought his first house about 5 years. And so all of a sudden, I mean, he was generating income. And the difference in those two and the income and, you know, their status or whatever you want to call it, is just incredible. And my nephew, he's only one example of the people that I've met in business that have become extremely successful. And I don't know if it's the risk taking or whether it's for me, I'll be honest with you. I think I could have been as successful with or without my engineering degree. I feel like it has served me well. It's allowed me the confidence to speak to people in bigger groups. It's allowed me the confidence to talk to engineers and scientists and geologists, you know, more on a par. However, I think, I don't know if I was designed to go to 4 years. I remember graduating from college with my civil engineering degree, and my wife asked me, she goes, "What's a civil engineer do?" And I said, "Well, they sit at a desk in an office and they design things." And she looked at me and she goes, "Do you really think you're going to be able to sit at a desk for the rest of your career?" And I thought to myself, she's probably right, you know? And so, I mean, I love the trades, and I feel like America needs to figure this out. I've done some talks and I've done some research. The average age of our minor pool of workers is like 56 years old. You know, that's, for some of them, that's 5, 6, 7 years away from retirement. Mm-hmm. And people aren't really excited about going into mining. And it's the same with construction. And so that's part of my passion for the trades. I've been able to go to community colleges. I've been able to go to high schools and talk to kids. One of the things that I love about some of these community colleges, again, I'm a football fan, but you think about the young men that sign a letter of intent to play football at a college, right? And the amount of, I call it a little bit of nonsense, the amount of, you know, hype and excitement and enthusiasm they get because this kid's going to go play football at some college. Well, I've always, and some of these community colleges, a business will sponsor them. Say, look, I'm going to pay for your 2 years of whatever you want to call it, trade school, you know, whether it's electrical or, you know, plumbing or welding, I'm going to pay for 2 years, but I'd like you to give me 2 years of service. And then you think about it. If I'm paying that kid's tuition for 2 years, I'm going to be engaged, right? Mm-hmm. Hey, how's it going? Do you need any help? And I just feel like, and so what I've been able to do is go to these signing of letter of intent with these businesses, which then build these kids up. And now all of a sudden they feel welcome into the industry. They feel like people care. And so I feel like if more high schools and more trade schools and more community colleges do that, I think it'll help. And so I enjoy going talking to the kids and handing them, you know, their tuition package or whatever it is. It's pretty cool. I like that.
Yeah, we see a big push in West Virginia. I think I mentioned this to you, even going into the fifth grade classes to discuss, to discuss the trades. You know, it goes on through middle school. I believe at least the county I live in, you can go to vocational school starting your junior year or at least halfway through your sophomore year. But it's like you say, a four-year college isn't for everyone. And that used to be what everyone preached was you got to go to four-year college, got to go to four-year college. And now I think kids are starting to see, and not just kids, but adults are starting to see that that's not the way it has to go. I mentioned to you, my nephew went to vocational school for the electrical program and came right out of high school, and he's doing great. He went straight into the workforce. Mm-hmm. But you, your nephew, my nephew are just two examples of many success stories in those regards. But, you know, I think that's the thing, that though, is the education part, you know, what you're going out and doing, educating people on it. To be honest with you, when I came out of high school, I had no idea what I wanted to do, but my mom had a cousin who had a geotechnical engineering company in Hawaii, and I thought, what a neat job and what a neat place to live. I'm going to be an engineer. And I went to one of our local engineering schools for 1 year and realized I still have no idea what engineering is. And I ended up closer to home at another college and picked accounting, but I really had no push or no guidance into the careers that were available, or now I was just going off of what I thought was cool.
Yeah. If I were to give my advice to somebody that has a high school student, it would be to give them a well-rounded education. And I'll use my grandson as an example. So my grandson now is a junior in high school. Smart, smart kid. I mean, a little bit too smart. But he's been on, when I mined, every year he came onto my site. And my wife and I would keep him for 1 year. It was a month and a half in Alaska. He ran equipment. He ran the gold room. He learned, you know, all kinds of things. And it gave him one, a work ethic, two, a well-rounded education. And now he's taken some auto classes. He's taken computer animation classes. I mean, but kids could be a straight A student. I mean, he's probably got a 3.85 GPA. I mean, he's got one or two B's is all, and the rest A's. But he's a kid that could easily step right into a college and go get a 4-year degree and just breeze through. I have no doubt. But he's in the process of building a 350 engine. He's going to put it in his grandma's car. And so he's well-rounded. He can do everything. I mean, he's got a 3D printer. He prints stuff off. He sells things. He's an entrepreneur. And I have no idea what the kid's going to do, but whatever he's going to do, he's going to be successful at it because he's so well-rounded, you know, and he rebuilds engines. And anyway, that's the kind of kid that I would hire in a heartbeat if he ever needed a job, because he's well-rounded. He can fix things, and plus he's really smart. So it's going to be fun to see where he goes.
Yeah.
And he's a great football player.
Well, how great, because WVU could really use some great football players right now. We're struggling. That wraps up part one of Constructive Conversations episode with legendary gold miner Dave Turin. Be sure to check out part two, soon to be released, where Dave and I will talk about many more interesting topics in construction, entrepreneurialism, and innovation. See you in part 2.